For a few moments, static filled her ears and heard thought that her hearing was damaged. But with a quick glance backward, she saw the dust rising behind her and realized what the sound was. A pair of small flechette autocannon were raking the outer grounds of the facility, orienting on the sound of her thudding steps. According to Alexander's researchers on the array facility, these cannon used listening devices in the ground to triangulate an intruder's position. But they were falling short, calibrated to hit someone running at normal human velocity. Even in the few meters between her footfalls and the listening devices, the tardy speed of sound made a difference. The incompetence of local militias here in the Spinwood Reaches always amazed her. She was glad the few hundred Imperial soldiers had been stretched so thinly across the planet. Suddenly, the dusty arcs of flechette fire rose up in front of her. Someone was recalibrating the autocannon in real time, trying to compensate for the Rixwoman's inhuman speed. The gun would catch her soon enough, if only by trial and error. At the moment, she was only a single variable problem. Hurd asked her internal software for a string of random numbers and shifted directions to irregularize her course. But the autocannon were spraying wildly now, their screeching reports pitched above 1,000 rounds per minute. They would find her eventually. A few hits wouldn't kill her, but she didn't have time for wounds. One arm wrapped around Rana Harta, Hurd adjusted the Varigun to a new setting at random with her teeth. Damn! The thing was badly designed. If only she had a spare second to pull her own weapon. Hurd aimed blindly without turning her head. Her eyes were a soft spot where even a mere flechette could kill her. Calculating on the fly, the center of an arc of impacts before her. Her weapon recoiled with a satisfying thump. 3 seconds later, a sharp boom rang out and one of the cannon was silenced. She swung the Varigun the other way, aiming at the center of the remaining arc of dust that swept toward her. Her finger closed on the firing stud. The gun beeped twice, with that apologetic timbre recognizable in all simple and stupid machines. The weapon had contained only one round at that setting. The stream of flechettes raced along the ground, reaching for her, and Hurd made a rare mistake. She timed the jump perfectly to clear the arc of fire, but didn't fully take into account the burden of Rana Harta over her shoulder. The commando's leap reached only 2 meters vertical, and 4 flechettes plunged into her. One struck her kneecap, flattened against the exposed hypercarbon, and slid off without leaving a scratch. Another hit a buttock, the small metal arrow tearing bloodily across a broad swath of skin as it bounced off the flexible subdermal armor that protected Rick's soldiers from falls. A third passed through her abdomen, nicking the impervious spine and shattering. The shrapnel perforated her stomach, which began healing itself immediately and destroyed 2 of her 7 kidneys. An acceptable loss. The only real damage came from the round that struck her left arm. It lodged in the radial notch, wedged as tight as a doorstop in the hypercarbon. Her forearm's flexibility was suddenly reduced to 0. A workaround radius activated itself instantly, allowing the arm to move again, but the strength of the needle-thin workaround was less than 10% normal. As they landed, Rana Harta fell from Hurd's suddenly weakened grasp and tumbled across the tundral grasses like a lifeless body thrown from a train. The commando regained her footing and turned to face the still shrieking autocannon. With the shaking hand of her damaged arm, she twisted the Varigun's control through its settings, raking the cannon's emplacement with infra-laser magnetic sniper rounds, anti-personnel explosives, a burst of tiny depleted uranium slugs, and a stream of microfoil chaff that set the air to sparkling brightly around her. The autocannon stuttered to a halt a few seconds before its firing arc would have found her again, either destroyed or overheated. Hurd's eyes spotted the thermals of more militia soldiers emerging from the array facility, now a kilometer away. They were staying low, moving forward nervously. She fired more microfoil chaff in their direction to baffle any sensors that could image Rana Harta's body heat, then emptied the rest of the chaff straight into the air. She scooped up her fallen burden. The glittering microfoil drifted along with Hurd, the wind at her back falling like metal snow as she plunged into the tundral waste. She traveled 20 kilometers before she thought to check Rana Harta for wounds. Another mistake. A host of bruises from the fall covered the woman's skin, and Hurd's thermal vision showed increased blood flow, the body responding to a sprained wrist. Rana's lower lip was bleeding. Her eyes were starting to flutter open. Only time would tell if a head injury had been sustained. Then Hurd saw, barely visible in the winter night starlight, the fingertip-sized, dark circle of blood staining the militia fatigues. Hurd knelt, blinded momentarily by a wave of some strange and awful emotion. Then she gathered herself and inspected the wound more closely. A flechette had passed straight through Rana's chest, hardly slowed by the flimsy calcium ribcage. The projectile was meant to turn to shrapnel inside the body, but had been designed for an armored target. Nothing in the woman's chest had resisted the shell enough to shatter it. It had missed her heart and spine, but had holed one lung. The woman's breath was fast and shallow. Hurd put her ear to the wound and listened for the telltale whisper of tension in pneumothorax, but no pressure was building in the chest cavity. The bleeding had stopped. Hurd sighed with relief, and something filled her vibrant and expansive. Not the mere satisfaction of a mission parameter fulfilled, but an animal feeling like the vigor of sex or the calming scent of her home orbital's familiar air. The cause of this feeling, this swelling of joy, Rana Harter would live. Senator. The war changed everything. The council met throughout the week, setting broad guidelines for the tumultuous shifts that would shake the 80 worlds for the next few decades. In the Spinwood Reaches, the council altered the reproduction and education laws. The next generation would have to be numerous, and it would have to grow up quickly. The expansionist senator on the council presented the proposal, using terms like replacement population. Nara Oxum found the euphemism repulsive. Why not simply call them war orphans? But she voted with the unanimous council, setting a generous birth dowry to be paid off in lands from the Imperial Conservancy. On 20 planets, virgin climax stage forests were parceled into bribes, remuneration for the most productive parents. By the time the hundreds of warships from anti-Spinwood reached their new assignments on the Rix frontier, the babies of this demographic bulge would be old enough to become marines, ground troops, replacements for the technical personnel sucked into the war effort. This oversized generation raised in the hinterland would stand ready to repopulate smashed cities, to recolonize dead planets if necessary. The stately pace of the Constant was a convenience in the prosecution of war, Oxum realized. Across the 30 light-year diameter of empire, war was slowed to a timescale in which human seed could be sown like summer crops, stacked and stored in preparation for leaner times. Even on her native Vasthold, 7 light-years from the Rix frontier, Oxum was forced to accept population increases that would cut deep into the unspoiled continents of the planet. Biomes that had taken centuries to stabilize raised overnight to make room for a generation of cannon fodder. The Empire girded itself for a bloodbath that might consume tens of billions. The expansionist senator sometimes waxed ecstatic as she outlined these plans, her mind alight with partisan fever. Her faction had long called for increased birth rates. The expansionists shared with the secularists and utopians a wariness of the growing power of the dead. But their motto was bury the dead with the living. They sought to redress the balance of power through sheer numbers, an ever-expanding population, and thus an ever-aggressive empire, in which the dead would never predominate. The Utopians took the opposite, equally unpragmatic tack. They promised universal elevation, in which the symbiont would be bestowed upon every citizen of empire upon death. Thus, the dead would represent all classes, and everyone would have a stake in immortality. To Senator Oxum and her secularist party, both these strategies were patently absurd. The great living masses of the expansionist vision were doomed to become an underclass. As an ancient philosopher had once said, the poor are only poor because of their great number. Add the immortality of the wealthy dead to the equation, and the class divisions in the risen empire could only worsen. The utopian future, in which billions were elevated every year, was equally untenable. It would choke the 80 worlds and bow the vital living under the weight of their ancestors. Both schemes would create population problems that could only be solved by conquest. The secularists had a simpler plan. They were, as Laurent had put so long ago, simply pro-death. Universal and irrevocable, natural death leveled all members of a society. Of course, the technology of the symbiont could never be uninvented, but its effects could be ameliorated as much as possible. Elevation should be rare, its rejection celebrated. And the secularists wanted the living to hold as much power as possible. The dead could stay in their grey enclaves and stare at their black walls, but could not use their unanimity and accumulated wealth to steer the course of empire. Thus, three parties, a clear majority of the Senate, stood against the Emperor, but theirs was a divided opposition. To bolster her case for increased population, the expansionist senator showed recordings from the first incursion. 80 years before, the Rix had sought to break the Empire's will, to force acceptance of compound mines within all imperial infrastructures. The incursion had opened with appalling terror attacks. Living cities were ruptured by chaotic gravity beams fired from space, buildings rendered as if made of straw, crowds sucked into scrambled piles, in which human forms commingled with metal and plastic and clothing. Grey enclaves were decimated with special munitions, Flechette cluster bombs that shredded victims beyond the symbiont's ability to repair. In rural areas not covered by nuclear dampening fields, clean bombs were used to destroy human and animal populations. Oxum contemplated the images. Death enough for anyone. Perhaps that was the seductive nature of war. It gave all parties what they thought they wanted. Millions of new elevated war heroes for the utopians, vast population increases for the expansionists, and plenty of true death for the secularists. And for the emperor and loyalty, a period of unquestioned authority. The dead sovereign nodded when the expansionist finally finished. Darkness was falling, and Oxum realized that she hadn't slept for two of Home's long days. The dead needed little sleep. They seemed to drift into an internal world for short, rejuvenating meditations. But the living members of the council looked exhausted. "I am glad you have chosen to prepare for the worst, Senator."
"Thank you, Your Majesty."
"Any objections?" the Sovereign asked. Nara realized that this was it. The whole package of population increases, of childhoods spent in military training, of countless virgin biomes raped, it all came down to a simple vote among a few exhausted men and women. It was all happening too fast. She cleared her throat. "Does it not seem to the Council that this Rix incursion is different from the first?"
"Different?"
asked a dead general.
"It has not yet begun in earnest."
But the last began so suddenly with a clear ultimatum, followed by a wave of simultaneous terror attacks on several worlds.
"Hasn't this incursion begun suddenly too, Senator Oxum?" the Emperor asked.
Nara had grown more adept in reading the man. He seemed intrigued.
"As suddenly, but with greater restraint," she began. "Only a single planet was attacked, and no civilian targets were destroyed." "They accomplished by blackmail what they could not by terror," the dead general answered. "A compound mind forced upon us by hostage-taking."
Oxum nodded, concealing a look of disgust. Though losing 4 billion lives, the Empire had never relented in the first incursion. But when the beloved Empress was threatened, they had let the Rix inside. "However appalling their choice of targets," she said, "the cult has shown tremendous focus in their attack. A single world, a single hostage, a limited result."
"But with absolute success," the Emperor said.
"An unrepeatable success, sire," she finished. She felt the Council recognize the truth of her words. The Rix could hardly take another hostage of the Empress's stature. No one except the Emperor himself would warrant the restraint that Zai had shown.
"Do you think that they'll stop now, Senator?"
"I think, sire, that they tried to bludgeon us into submission once and failed. This time they have decided on a more subtle approach." She looked around the circle, saw the councillors' attention beginning to focus through their fatigue. "We don't know what their ultimate plan is," she continued, "but it would be odd for them to begin the war with such a precisely delivered stroke, only to return to the crude terror tactics of the first incursion." The dead general narrowed his eyes.
"Granted, Senator. As you said, their subtle victory is an unrepeatable one, but surely it is also purposeful. They have a viable mind on an imperial world, and they are moving to communicate with it. They clearly intend to gain some strategic advantage from their occupation of Legis.
An advantage that could lead to terrors like those of the first incursion," the Emperor continued the thought. "If they can tap the knowledge of their mind on Legis, they will know us better than they did a century ago."
"Would that they knew our fortitude," Raz Impar Henders said.
"An interesting expression, Senator Henders," the Emperor said. "Perhaps we should demonstrate how great a sacrifice we are willing to make."
"What sacrifice could be greater than the 4 billion lost in the first incursion, sire?" Axmilk asked. "The Rix should know us well enough by now."
The Emperor nodded in contemplation, and the Council stayed respectfully quiet. Finally, he said,
"We shall have to consider that question."
Nara Oxum saw it then in the dead sovereign's thoughts, the hulking shadow of his fear, the strength of his resolution. The Emperor's will had reached an absolute condition. He would do anything to prevent the Ricks from communicating with their mind. If the Lynx failed, something awful was going to happen. Executive Officer. They met the next time in Hobbs's cabin. She didn't want this grim rehearsal sullying her small private domain. But hers was the cabin on the Lynx, most similar to Zai's, the same size and shape, except that it lacked the captain's sky room. It was close enough. The conspirators stood in their positions uncomfortably, mock assassins playing at a game they were still afraid to make real.
"Are you sure you can get us in?"
Magis asked her again. Hobbs nodded.
"I've had the captain's codes for months. He sometimes sends me to his cabin if he's forgotten something."
"What if he's changed them?"
"He hasn't," she said flatly. Hobbs wished that Magis would shut up about this. It didn't do for them to examine her claims too closely.
"Trust Hobbs," Thompson said to the third pilot. "She's always had the old man's ear."
The words struck Hobbs with palpable force, a wave of guilt like some tendril of gravity whipping through her stomach. Gunnar Thompson trusted her completely now, and there was more than trust behind his eyes, her utopian beauty complicating things again. She saw the others reacting to Thompson's words, questioning his blind faith. Magis was still far warier of Hobbs than he, and who had apparently started to think that this had all been her idea rather than Thompson's. She would have to watch her back.
"Come in, King,"
Thompson ordered. Ensign King entered the cabin, a nervous look on his face. His job during the murder would be to block the ship's recording devices. He would be at his communications station, so he was standing in for Captain Zai. Magis and Hobbs took his arms, exchanging the timid looks of an unsure rehearsal, and pulled him forward carefully. This was during the daily half-hour break from high acceleration. The Lynx was under a mercifully steady single G, but they all still moved with exaggerated care, their bodies conditioned to caution over the last 5 days. Thompson crouched in the center of the cabin on the ceremonial mat, a blade of error in his hand. The blade was a gift from his father, he had explained, for his graduation from the academy. What a morbid present, Hobbs thought. She hadn't known Thompson's family was so grey. Indeed, all the conspirators were from conservative families. That was the irony of this situation. Mutiny was hardly an imperial tradition. But of course, it was the Greys who were most appalled by Captain Zai's rejection of the blade. Hobbs and Magis pushed King forward, and Thompson rose to thrust his empty fist into the ensign's stomach. He mimed the crosscut of the blade ritual and stepped back as King crumpled convincingly to the mat. The conspirators regarded the still body before them.
"How do we know this will fool anyone?" Magis complained. "None of us has ever worked in forensics." "There won't be a full investigation," Thompson said.
"A suicide with no recording? Won't my equipment failure be a little suspicious?" King said, rising from the mat.
"Not under heavy acceleration," Hobbs said. 7 days into the maneuver, systems were failing intermittently throughout the ship. The ship's circuitry was at the bleeding edge of its self-repair capacity. So was the crew's nervous system, Hobbs reckoned. Tempers had grown short. A few times over the last 10 hours, she'd wondered if the conspirators would fall to fighting amongst themselves. She had hoped the mutiny would have crumbled under its own weight by now.
"Don't worry," Thompson said. "Any anomalous forensic evidence will be put down to easy gravity effects." "Even the blood all over your uniform?" Magis said. "I'll space the damn thing. But a thorough investigation is at Captain Hobbs's discretion," Thompson insisted.
They all looked at her. Again, she felt the weight of the conspiracy upon her. Hobbs wondered when she had become the leader of this mutiny. Was she leading them all further into this than they would have gone if she'd simply ignored Thompson's insinuations? She forced the doubts from her mind. Second thoughts were an exercise in pointlessness. Hobbs was committed now and had to act the part. "This will be deemed suicide officially," she said. "That will be the reasonable and politically acceptable interpretation." They nodded one by one, agreement, a virus spreading through the room. By mentioning the political situation, she had suggested that they were following the apparatus's implicit wishes. With every utterance, her hands were dirtier.
"So it's settled," Thompson said.
Then, to Magis and Hobbs,
"You two can handle Zai."
"No problem," Magis said.
She stood almost 2 meters tall. Under normal conditions, she alone could easily murder a man of Zai's slight build. But Captain Zai was integrally part of the Lynx. The conspirators couldn't give him time to shout to the ship's AI or work a gestural command. If he had prepared himself for mutiny, defensive orders programmed into his cabin's intelligence could be invoked with a gesture, a syllable. For the plan to work, they all knew, the deed had to be done in seconds and in total surprise. It was time to press this point. "He might have time to shout something," Hobbs said. "You'll have to cover his mouth, Thompson." The gunner looked at her with concern. "While I stab him? I've got to hit him square in the stomach. No one will believe a messy wound." Magis looked worried. "Maybe Yen Hu." The gunner's mate swallowed nervously. He didn't want to be included in the actual violence. Under Thompson's plan, he was supposed to be lookout, to warn them if anyone was with the captain, and to let them know when they could exit the cabin without being seen. "He needs to stay outside," Thompson said. "You do it, Hobbs. Just hit him in the mouth." "I've got to keep a hold on his hands," Hobbs argued. "You've seen how fast he works air screens. He could send an alert with one finger."
"Maybe we should just knock him out," Magis suggested.
"Forget it," Hobbs said. "The adept is bound to notice any trauma to his head. The politicals will at least take a look at him." They were silent for a moment. Hobbs watched their unsurety rise as they cast glances at one another. However many times they had all fired weapons in anger, the physical nature of a murder by hand was dawning on them. Maybe this would be the moment the conspirators would come to their senses.
"I'll take the risk. Let's knock him out," Thompson said.
Magis nodded. Hobbs sighed inwardly. They were set on their course.
"No," she said flatly. "I'm the one who has to cover this up. I say we need another person."
Hobbs watched Thompson carefully. Her reason for continuing this far, besides the hope that the conspirators might relent and redeem themselves to some small extent, was to flush out any unknown mutineers. She saw Thompson start to speak, but he swallowed the words. He was definitely hiding something, still keeping someone in reserve. Perhaps he had plans for Hobbs herself after the ship fell into her hands. The thought chilled Hobbs, steeling her will.
"I know someone," she said. "He's quick and strong."
"You can trust him?"
"I don't want anyone else,"
Magis protested.
"He's with us already," Hobbs interrupted. She looked coolly into the stunned faces.
"He came to me, wondering if there was anything he could do."
Thompson shook his head on the edge of disbelief.
"You think you're the only ones who don't want to die?" she asked.
"He just came to you," Thompson asked, "suggesting a mutiny."
She nodded. "I'm the executive officer."
"Who is it, Hobbs?"
"A marine private." No sense giving them a name. They'd have time to check her story.
"A grunt?"
Magis cried. Darren King looked appalled. They were both from solid Navy families.
"As I said, he's fast. In hand to hand, he could take us all."
"Do you trust him?"
Thompson asked, narrowing his eyes as he watched her reaction.
"Absolutely," she answered. That much, at least, was true.
Commando. The recon flyer was kept aloft by both fans and electromagnetics. A sensible design, limited by Imperial technology, neither propulsion system alone was sufficient for a fast armored vehicle. Moreover, if either system failed suddenly, the other would provide for a relatively soft landing. Only a hit that crippled both would crash the flyer. It was Herd's intent, however, to keep the vehicle in good working order. She would have to bring it down intact, although both of the soldiers on board would have to die. She could see one of them clearly, silhouetted against the aurora borealis, his head low as he peered into the glowing northern quadrant of the sky. They were bringing the craft in slowly toward their find, unsure yet whether to call for reinforcements. They were duly cautious, no doubt aware that the fugitive Rix commando had killed 21 of her pursuers and shot down one other flyer to date. But Herd knew that they would hesitate to ask for assistance. Herd had been tracking this flyer for 3 hours, arranging a series of false targets for the crew. At the beginning of their shift, she'd set out a sack full of trapped Arctic hares. As intended,
the animal's combined body heat had shown up as a human-scale thermal image on Imperial equipment. The recon flyer crew called for backup. The militia surrounded the squirming sack with 50 troopers, then peppered the captive hares with stun grenades. The hares had somehow remained conscious when a grenade burst the sack, resulting in a sudden explosion of dazed and fleeing rabbits. And that was only the first embarrassment of the day for the two recon soldiers. During the short daylight portion of their shift, the pair and the flyer had heard a rain of hard projectiles pounding their craft's armor and seen muzzle flashes. They reported themselves to be under hostile fire. A squadron of jump jets soon arrived, but the projectiles turned out to be a freak occurrence of localized hail. The muzzle flashes that the pilot had seen were merely reflections from an exposed, mica-rich escarpment. The calculations required to bend Legis's cloud-seeding dirigibles to this purpose had strained even Alexander's computing resources. But shining up the mica with her field laser had been easy for Herd. In the few hours since this last embarrassment, the luckless recon flyer crew had been traveling in slow circles. Its onboard computer, like all military AIs, was independent from the planetary web and therefore immune to Alexander's control. But it still relied on data from the planet's weather satellites to perform dead reckoning navigation. The shape of the terrain below changed constantly with snowdrifts and glacial cleaving, and the flyer's computer received frequent updates. Alexander had spoofed it with subtle manipulations of the data, gradually reducing the navigation software's democratically redundant neural net to total anarchy. By this point, the troopers knew their machine was confused and lost, but however tired and threadbare their nerves were, the two were reluctant to call for help a third time. And now they'd found another target. The glacial rift before them held a heat signature of human scale. Rana Harter was inside, feverish from her wound and breathing raggedly. The flyer crew would soon be certain that they finally had a real target. A small shape lowered from the flyer, Herd's sharp ears picking up the whine of its propulsion fan. The remote drone wafted down from the safe high altitude that the flyer maintained and moved into the mouth of the rift. Using her communication bioware, Herd scanned the EM range for the drone's control frequency. She could hardly believe it. The drone was using simple, unencrypted radio. Herd linked into its point-of-view transmission. Soon the ghostly figure of Rana Harter appeared at the edge of discernibility in the drone's crude night vision. The commando jammed the connection with a squawk of radio, the sort of EM bump often caused by Legis's northern lights. Herd waited anxiously. Had she allowed them too clear a view of Rana? If they called for backup now, the situation might spiral out of control. Rana might be killed by the militia's clumsy, paranoid doctrine of overwhelming force. The recon flyer hovered for a few interminable minutes, almost motionless in the calm air. No doubt the tired, harried troopers were debating what to do. Finally, a second recon drone descended from the flyer. Herd jammed it the moment it entered the rift. This time the recon flyer moved in reaction. As Herd had hoped, it descended, trying to re-establish line of sight with the lost drones. The craft's forward guns targeted the rift's opening. The commando allowed a few images to pass through her electronic blockade, tempting the recon flyer farther downward. She noted that Rana had moved out of the drone's sight. Good. She was still thinking clearly. Rana's concussion worried Herd. The woman was lucid one moment, incoherent the next. Taking the bait, the flyer lowered itself one last critical degree. Herd burst out of her covering of snow and thermal camouflage skin. The commando threw her snare at the rear of the Imperial machine. The polyfilament line was anchored on both ends with depleted uranium slugs. It flew with the orbit-like sway of a bowler, rotating around its center of gravity as it rose, the polyfilament invisibly thin. Herd's aim was true, and the makeshift bowler tangled in the rear fans of the flyer. The machine screamed like a diving hawk as the unbreakable fibers exceeded the fan's tolerances. Herd's night vision spotted a few metal shapes spinning from the wounded flyer. She ducked as a whirring sound passed close by her head and set her jamming bioware to attack every frequency the flyer might use to summon help. The recon flyer's front reared up like a horse, the undamaged forward fan still providing thrust, and it began to slip backwards as if sliding down some invisible hill. Herd drew her knife and ran toward the careening craft. She heard the front fans shut down, an emergency measure to level the flyer. The electromagnetic lifters flared with an infrasonic hum, the static electricity raising small hairs on Herd's arms. She felt lightning in the air as the recon flyer's descent began to slow, rebounding softly just before it reached the snowy ground. Herd had timed her approach perfectly.
As the flyer reached its lowest point, she jumped. The flexile metal soles of her bare feet landed on the flyer's armored